to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Jim Wiltrow.
And this is, Happy New Year to all of our listening audience out there in Radio Land. Being the first year or first show of 2013, we're going to get that up and get my mouth working a little bit better here. This is going to be our year in review show. Now, Between the Margins is a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. And 2012 is it has been a brutal year for human rights around the world. So probably this is going to be the little shop of horrors show. I mean, the only good thing that probably happened is, the world didn't end in 2012. So, that's probably really good, really good news, I guess.
To go through exams.
Yeah, and all that. And, this is actually a pretty big celebration here Between the Margins. And, because this is our fourth annual review show, which, we started back in 2009 doing this show. And, you can listen to all of our shows on www.betweenthemargins.ca. We've covered everything from accessibility to human rights to disability to special needs to feminism, women's issues to, the whole gambit is on there. There's, not quite 100 shows on there yet, but we're moving close on to that milestone show. So, to start this all off, I thought I would tell you the 10 most downloaded shows for Between the Margins up until December 31st. And at number 11, we have the Islamophobia show. And at number 10, we have the Weight Discrimination show. At number 9, we have the Aboriginal show. At number 8, we have the HIV/AIDS show. At number 7, one of my favorite shows, the Un-Christmas show. And then we have, at number 6, we have our LGBT youth death show, talking about teen suicide in the LGBT community. And in the top 5, we have the LGBT parenting show, talking about being a parent with LGBT youth. Number 4 is our hate crime show on the hate crimes that the two gay guys that got bashed in London, Ontario, and explaining the criminal code and how it deals with hate crimes. Number 3 has the infamous Josh Blue in it. It's the Paralympic show, and he's the comic that won Last Comic Standing a few years ago, and he's the... And that show is the third show. And number 2 and number 1 are Trans Women's Voices in the Trans Show. So transgender, transsexual, trans issues, gender identity and gender expression are by far the number 1 human rights issues that our listeners here at Between the Margins are listening to on a regular basis. So we want to just say thank you to all of our listeners out there, and thank you so much for being with us, and through all of the years that we've had this show, doing what we do, and educating you on human rights here in London, here in Canada, and around the world, and talking about Canada, and, we've been saying this all year, and, we've been saying it since 2006, when a certain individual came into the political limelight of Canada and made the promise that if he ever had a majority government, that we would not recognize our country when he was done. Well, I'm hoping he's done soon, because we already don't recognize our country, And the rest of the world has taken notice. And in Canada, who has been known forever as a world leader in peacekeeping, in human rights, in leading the world, in respecting individualism and the diversity that we find on this planet, has been flushed down the toilet by the Honorable Mr. Harper. And unfortunately, this is the year that Canada has been assessed. There's periodic assessments carried out every 4 or 5 years, and this just happens to be the year 2012 that Canada was assessed. And in December, Amnesty International posted the results of the human rights record of Canada, and there is 3 reports where Canada gets a failing grade in all 3 reports. And Amnesty reported that, by every measure, be it respect for treaty and land rights, levels of poverty, average lifespans, violence against women and girls, dramatically disproportionate levels of arrest and incarceration or access to government services such as housing, healthcare, education, water, child protection, Indigenous peoples across Canada continue to face a grave human rights crisis. And, status of women in 2006, we were rated something like 14th in the world, 14th in the world, and now we're rated on like 36 or something on the world stage. Third world countries have better ratings than Canada does when it comes to status of women issues. And let's drop right into status of women. And 2012, at the beginning when we did this show, we showed the human rights, or the UN stated that women's rights were going to be the leading issue facing the world in 2012, and that is definitely the case in 2012. The UN called it right, and it's the women's issues clip. And it's listen to this clip and listen to how brutal the world is for women.
Moving on to other news now. This is a big shocker for Delhi. Delhi has reinforced its reputation as one of the country's most unsafe cities. A 23-year-old woman was allegedly gang-raped in a moving bus last night. As if that isn't enough, the victim was then stripped and thrown off the moving bus on a flyover near the international airport. She has been admitted at Delhi's Safdarjung Hospital. Her condition is believed to be critical. What we learn is that the victim, along with a male friend, boarded a white line private bus at around 11 p.m. from Manuka in South Delhi to go to Palam, where she lives. About 10 minutes later, a few people on her bus began harassing her. When her friend objected, they allegedly beat him up with an iron rod and then dragged the woman to the bus cabin where they raped her. The victim is a medical student while her friend is employed in a software firm.
So many homeless, hungry, tired and sick. This is the Goma region of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Here, endless conflicts bring unending misery to thousands of displaced people. And along with the challenges of surviving, danger is never far afield, particularly for the women. A few months ago, 17-year-old Flo, whose identity we are protecting, was ambushed.
Mushamba niko natumika. I was working in our farm. They came intimidating me with their guns. They told me, if you don't let us rape you, we will kill you. And so they forced me down, raped me, and then left.
A few months later, she found out she was pregnant. She was one of 5 women who were raped that evening. The latest fighting between government forces and the rebel group M23 has brought a new wave of assaults. UNHCR received dozens of reports of rape and attacks against women. 27-year-old Elaine, whose identity we're protecting also, is another victim.
They forced me on the ground, then they raped me. They left me in pain. The following morning, I went to hospital where I was given medication.
Elaine cannot forget what happened to her as her five-year-old boy watched helplessly, screaming. And so through the tears of rape, she and many other women find a way to keep going. Still, the harshness of the reality here makes it one of the most dangerous places in the world for women.
That report by Edith Champagne of UNHCR.
I'm Irene Matheson. I'm the Member of Parliament for London Fanshawe, currently the NDP critic for pensions, and for 4.5 years, the critic for the status of women.
Wonderful. So you are the person to talk about the status of women here in Canada.
Yes, I had a lot of experience and a lot of time to see what was going on in this country, and certainly a great deal of time to meet with women's groups right across the country in response to what they were seeing and what we were seeing as NDP parliamentarians. And I can say that it was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. It's not getting any better, and in fact, women are further and further and further behind. It really is a matter of not making any significant progress since the late 1980s, and that is something I think that all women should be not just aware of, but pushing back against, because we cannot continue to slip backwards. There has to be a real and genuine effort to address the issue of women's equality, and there's none in this country at this point.
Are you familiar at all with the gender gaps study?
Yes, as it particularly as it relates to pay equity and all of the I guess opportunities for women in regard to their access to employment insurance, their access to housing and child care. And of course, I know that 60% of all seniors living in poverty are women.
We tend to stay marginalized and a percentage back, don't we?
Oh yes, very much so. Because there is no voice. And if you look at what has happened since just since the Conservatives became the government in 2006, the first thing that they did was to insist that budgets be cut, that there be a shift. And at that point, if folks will remember, we were in a surplus situation. The government of Canada was in a surplus situation. And the devastating recession that we saw in the United States in 2008 and that really hit us about 2009 was nowhere on the radar. So for them to begin to cut and reduce the obligation of government in regard to women's equality made no sense at all. It simply made no economic sense or social sense, but they did cut, and they said that they were no longer in the business of supporting the women's organizations that have done a great deal, have done so much since the 1960s in regard to pushing that agenda for women's equality.
And that's Canada. And, you know, in Russia, a few girls have gotten themselves into a little bit of trouble fighting for women's rights. And, you know, Pussy Riot is a Russian feminist punk rock collective based out of Moscow. And, you know, if you haven't heard of Pussy Riot, then Google them and listen to them. They were founded in 2011, and they have a variable number of women that that are part of the band. They're 11 women ranging in age from 20 to 33 who have bright colored balaclava, only use nicknames during interviews, and they staged a guerrilla attack on a church, an Orthodox church, in protest of the Putin regime in Russia, and it was the Cathedral of Christ the Savior Church, and two members of the group Nadia Stoykova and Maria Alkina were arrested and charged with hooliganism, and last time I checked, they were sentenced to hard labor in a work camp in Russia, and this is a clip about Pussy Riot.
Change. We can show that it's not so scary to do something, and that our actions are changing the situation.
It's really a very big problem that the Russian society is very patriarchal, and we believe that Russia needs some feminist movement, some
feministic list.
A whip. It's called a whip.
Whip. So Russia really needs some feminist whip.
You have to go home and find your balaclava. And
yeah, kind of. Or it's like Batman, you always have it with you.
Really?
Yeah. It's kind of Russian, super Russian version of being superhero. Maybe someday something will make a movie about Pussy Riot.
That's Pussy Riot. So, yeah, those girls are creating havoc in Russia, and havoc needs to be created in Russia with their attacks on free speech and all of the other, you know, huge, huge, huge demonstrations happening in Russia. And I think that's probably, you know, the buzzword for 2011 and 2012 is that, you know, it's the years of protests. And we're having, you know, people have had enough. And I think that's the entire way to sum it up is, you know, from the Arab Spring all the way through Syria and all the rest of the world, you know, people have had enough. And, you know, but I'm sorry about that, guys. My tongue's just is not working. Ban Ki-moon, the chairman of the UN, had his address summing up his opinions of 2012 around the world and the major issues facing the UN.
The Secretary General told reporters that 2012 saw tension in various parts of the world, from Syria to the Sahel, and from Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo to the Korean Peninsula. On Syria, Mr. Ban said the country began the year in conflict and ends it in war, with the death toll climbing and regional spillover growing.
The Syrian opposition is coming together. This is critical. I'm deeply concerned about the increased militarization of the conflict and the potential for sectarian atrocities. Earlier this month, the Deputy Secretary General visited Lebanon, where government officials and others voiced serious concern about the worsening regional implications. I visited myself Syrian refugees in Jordan and Turkey to see the situation for myself.
Mr. Ban said the exodus from Syria has reached more than 500,000 people, and it will grow as fighting rages. The Secretary General also touched on the crisis in the Sahel region of Africa.
In the Sahel region, some 20 million people across nine countries are in crisis, their lives upended by the volatile mix of drought, hunger, poor governance, drug trafficking, terrorism, and extremism. The situation in Mali is especially urgent. We must do all we can to help Malians restore their democracy, recover their territory, address the humanitarian crisis, and end the shocking human rights violations.
Turning to the ongoing crisis in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Mr. Ban said it remains the scene of instability, including sexual violence committed by combatants on all sides. The Secretary General also spoke about Northeast Asia.
In Northeast Asia, at a time when many countries are undergoing leadership transitions, I hope high priority will be given by the new leaders to building a more prosperous future based on stability and the peaceful resolution of disputes. The provocative rocket launched by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has raised regional concerns and defied the international community. I look forward to the outcome of Security Council consultations on an appropriate response.
Mr. Ban condemned the killing of health workers who are helping to vaccinate children against polio in Pakistan. Regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Secretary General said the Middle East peace process is in what he calls a deep freeze.
The two sides seem more polarized than ever, and the two-state solution is farther away than at any time since the Oslo process began. I'm deeply concerned by heightened settlement activity in the West Bank, in particular around Jerusalem. This gravely threatens efforts to establish a viable Palestinian state. I call on Israel to refrain from continuing on this dangerous path, which will undermine the prospects of a resumption of dialogue and the peaceful future of Palestinians and Israelis alike.
The Secretary General said the global economy continues to leave too many people behind, and as the UN reported in its latest economic outlook, growth continues to be weak. Mr. Ban also spoke about positive developments that are taking place, including political transitions in Libya, Myanmar, Somalia, and Yemen.
Last month, Sierra Leone held successful elections. At the end of this month, the UN peacekeeping mandate in Timor-Leste will end a measure of the progress the country has made from fragility to stability. Egypt's transition is at another critical moment. I have spoken with President Morsi in recent days and expressed my hope that the transition will be able to move forward in a peaceful, consensual manner.
In the past year, the United Nations also took major steps to advance economic and social progress and to build solid foundations for long-term peace, the Secretary General said. On climate change, he said the conference held in Doha, Qatar earlier this month delivered what is needed for a legally binding global agreement by 2015. He said 2012 also saw the launch of crucially important discussions on the post-2015 development agenda and a set of sustainable development goals. Derek Mbata, United Nations.
And as you can see, the situation in the world isn't all that much better than here in, at home in Canada. And, you know, human rights are suffering everywhere. And, you know, people need to step up the game. And, you know, start treating each other with a lot more respect and a lot more dignity, you know, worldwide. And, you know, teach your boys and your men not to rape women. You know, teach all your children to get along, be good people, and all of that stuff. So, we're going to talk about some of the good things that happened. And, you know, some good things happen in the world of human rights. You know, we've had some very successful campaigns across Canada, you know, the Enbridge line, the Enbridge pipeline. We've been very successful in ending that, you know, by using peaceful protesting and lobbying of the government and you know, telling Harper's Canada that our Canada does not include dirty oil pipelines running through some of the most pristine forest and nature areas in Canada. And, you know, the risks in Kitimat Bay are not worth what he thinks they are. And, you know, giving our oil to China with no return to Canadians is really not worth the investment. So we've told Harper this. And, you know, here's a clip of some of the people, you know, telling Enbridge exactly what they think.
Bring us to tears. We don't need people down here who do not support the Enbridge pipeline.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that is some of the dirtiest, most carbon-intensive oil in the world. And there was a fellow from Vancouver who coined this phrase. He said the Enbridge pipeline would be a pipeline from the tar sands directly to our planet's atmosphere.
And a lot of people also are concerned or against this proposal. And we have a banner on our sailboat that says no place for tankers. So we have received, you know, incredible support for that. And I'm here today because I'm also concerned.
Are you surprised how many people came up from Kelowna to oppose the pipeline?
I think that there could have been 100,000 more.
I agree.
No tankers.
No tankers.
No problem.
Well, really, it starts at the top. That is Mr. Harper.
Mr. Harper.
And his almost arrogance, I would say, at using the appearance of a democratic society.
So Canadians have been very successful in telling Harper exactly what we think of selling our country out to China. And you know, the Quebec student movement was very, very successful in telling Jean Charest that he can take it and stick it up his left sunshine and twist.
Which they did and sent him home.
And they sent him packing. So Canadians out there, you know, peaceful protest works, and the Occupy movement, where we have the meetings called, anyways, it's in the clip. Let's go to the clip on the Quebec student movement, and then we'll talk about it.
More than 165,000 students in Quebec have been on strike for more than 11 weeks in order to pressure the provincial Liberal government of Jean Charest to go back on its decision to increase tuition rates, some of the lowest in Canada, by 75% over the next 5 years. On April 18th, The Real News met with student leaders Alex Mitak, Jeremy Bedard-Huin, and Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois to discuss some of the origins and strategies of what has quickly become North America's largest student movement.
For students, student organizers and activists in other parts of the country, you're looking at Quebec and saying, how did you guys do that? How are you able to mobilize 250,000 people and continue a strike for 10 weeks? You know, I guess if you guys could share some of your insight on the Quebec student experience and what students in other universities and other settings, the United States and Canada and even beyond, what are some of the things they can learn from the Quebec student example?
One of the main examples of how we are able to mobilize such a broad number of students is that our student unions are inherently political. And they operate, the ones that are members of class, they operate according to principles of direct democracy, therefore involving a maximum amount of students in general assemblies, which function day-to-day, which is usually the highest governing body of these unions. Therefore, a maximum number of students are able to participate in the daily political life of their student unions instead of dedicating power to a group of individuals, like it happens on so many Anglophone campuses outside Quebec and even within Quebec.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that definitely was the change that happened this year at Concordia, where typically the political structure is that of a student union that is elected in hierarchical and people can speak through some other representative. And I think for the first time ever this year, smaller student associations have become political and have started having general assemblies where people had a direct say in not only a direct vote, but a direct say in shaping the thing that they would be voting on and really owning that. And when it began, it was a few student member associations that did that, and it quickly snowballed into something really huge, because that kind of participation is what so many students have been waiting for a long time. And I think that in and of itself, that cultural change towards direct instances of direct democracy was enough to mobilize people towards something like a strike.
And we're back, and we'll be back after these break with Between the Margins here at CHRW 94.9 FM, talking more about what happened in 2012. And you're back to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Kim Gautreaux.
And we're reviewing and talking about the, you know, the top happenings in 2012. And, you know, so much happened that we're skipping through as fast as we can. And just remember to go and look at, if you want to hear about any of these issues in more detail, to www.betweenthemargins.ca and listen to the full shows on the issues. So, we are talking about the General Assembly's working so well with the Quebec student strike to mobilize so many people, and we need to do more of this direct democracy around the province, because our democracy is failing on the most part. I mean, we look at the Bill 115, where, you know, our democracy has decided to not be democratic and take away the teachers' rights in this province, and eliminate collective bargaining and destroy everything that we've worked for all of these years, and all of the rules that we've set in place to, you know, come to terms with labor disputes and disagreements over, you know, how much money someone should be paid and how much someone's willing to pay them. So, you know, just throw all that out. And all of that work, and no, we're just going to legislate, and you make too much money, so nobody will mind if we just, you know, screw it to you. So, teachers out there, in solidarity with you, you know, around the education, we did make great headway with the GSA bill, Bill 13, and here's Sherry DeNovo talking about it.
Mr. Speaker, and it's an honor and privilege to stand today to speak about Bill 13. And you know, quite frankly, this is not a partisan issue. There is, of course, sentiment all around the House that what we want to do and what we stand together on, shoulder to shoulder, as it were, is to keep our children safe, to prevent teen suicide, the kind of occurrence that happened with our friend Jamie and others who have killed themselves because of bullying in their schools. We are speaking really together around this issue. We had here some incredibly courageous young people. We had Trevor James, who is a straight youth from Peterborough. He was flanked, and I'm quoting here from the Toronto Star article, by Leanne Iskander, 17, who self-identified as queer, and Christopher McCarricker, 16, a bisexual man, both from Mississauga St. Joseph Secondary School. Here's a quote from James. He said, "I love my school. It's my home away from home. We are not fighting. We just want to be treated equally. If we do not accept racism and nationalism in school, why is it okay to be homophobic? To call these clubs anything but gay straight alliances is a denial of queer students' existence," added James, a student at St. Peter's Secondary School. And Leanne Iskander, who has organized a group of Catholic students for gay straight alliances. Again, kudos to her.
So we made grounds, and I mean, it's very, very crucial at this point, as teachers in Ontario are working to rule and not performing extracurricular activities in the school, to remind those teachers that the GSA clubs that are in the school are not designated as extracurricular. They're legislated, mandated clubs, and they need to continue those clubs, and because they're there for the safety of students, and you know, not They're not extracurricular activities. And you know, teachers need to, and administration, I mean, if teachers won't do them, then admin has to be step up, and they have to facilitate those groups in the schools because they are legislated. So trans people in Ontario and Canada have, you know, had a really active year. Definitely have shown government that if they want to make themselves known as a political entity, then they're not to do so on the backs of trans people. And if they try it, they're going to get stepped on, as Anders in Alberta has found out, along with, you know, Tim Hudak at the last election in 2012, where, you know, he tried to make a mockery of trans people, putting out hate propaganda against the trans population, and we called him on that, and is probably one of the major reasons that it cost him the last election. So, you know, politicians are slowly getting to understand that, you know, trans people are pretty large number of people in society. There's, you know, a number of activists out there that, you know, are just not going to call for this thing. And, you know, all three parties in the legislature all agreed to pass Toby's Act in the Ontario legislature in 2012 to add gender identity and gender expression to the Human Rights Code and to put a foundation in place for the rights of trans people, and all three parties in Ontario got the message that this is important, and, you know, you need to do it. And, you know, a few others took on big names, Jenna Telikova, thank you. You know, she really, you know, took on somebody huge.
The Miss Universe pageant.
The Miss Universe pageant and Billionaires Club. And won that battle. And here's a short clip. Barbara Walters interviewed Jenna. And here's just a little piece of that.
Jenna, when did you first know that you were different?
I just always knew that I was not what they were saying. It wasn't right. I thought that I was in the wrong body.
You had years of therapy. You had hormone treatments. What did the hormone treatments do for you?
I took estrogen, which, you know, helped me develop my own breast and, you know, just, you know, keep my skin as it was. And just, it made me feel better mentally, but I could feel it hormonally as well.
When you had your surgery, what did they do?
The surgery is pretty intense. It was terribly painful, but seeing something on your body for that long and not being able to look at myself in the mirror because I couldn't stand seeing the other part, it was actually very rewarding too.
But on others as well.
I feel like the universe, the creator, just put me in this position as an advocate, and now it's like this, and I'll take that position if it's helping anybody else, my story and my actions, then I feel great about it.
So Jenna took on the world and the universe and won, and she got to step onto stage as a Miss Universe contestant and you know, set in motion, you know, another person that trans people around the world can look up to that's on the public stage. But, you know, on the downside for trans people in Canada, you know, Harper's government has decided that trans people cannot fly. And here is, there was 2-3 weeks of question period taken up on this, and still Harper refused to step down and step aside on this issue.
Ms. Chow?
The motion in front of us is, let me read it in its entirety, that the government repeals Section 5.2 of the identity screening regulations under the Aeronautics Act, which were introduced in August 2011, and which states that an air carrier shall not transport a passenger if the passenger does not appear to be of gender indicated on the identification he or she presents. as this is a severe discrimination against transgendered and transsexual Canadians and a violation of the fundamental right, the freedom of movement, and that this motion be reported back to the House.
How much do we love Olivia Chow?
We love Olivia Chow. And you know, she's there along with Randall Garrison fighting in the House for trans rights. And we love them to pieces.
And a personal thank you to both of them.
And a personal thank you to both of them. And right now, the trans bill is before the Commons. And that's including gender identity and gender expression. And Canadian MPs need to pass this bill the same as Ontario did. And you know, last time there was it passed through the House and then didn't clear the Senate, and we were sitting there and watching all of those conservative MPs standing up and saying that a trans person is not a human being and voting no. And I don't know how anybody can stand up and say someone is not a human being in the House of Commons who is a Canadian citizen. And shame, shame, shame on anyone that votes against that bill.
So this is where you can get a little active. Write to your member of parliament and tell them that they need to pass this bill. It is really close. Votes coming up pretty soon, I believe.
Very soon.
And there's no reason it shouldn't pass the next reading. So,
absolutely.
Aside from Rob Anders and his super fun petition.
So here in London, Susan Thorpe, Joe Preston, and Ed, whatever his name is. Yeah, escaping me, but all three conservative MPs stood up in the House and said trans people are not people the last time they voted for this, and, you know, that's not okay, and storm the castles, folks. So, a major issue for trans people and trans youth across this country is the exorbitant amount of bullying that trans youth are facing in schools. And Kim and I both run a trans youth group every Thursday at Central Library here in London, Ontario, called Trans Youth London. And the horror stories that come out of this group are absolutely unbelievable, folks. I mean, you would think that we were living in a third world country and the schools were run by armed bandits, the stories that we have with these kids. And here's one student standing up and talking about her experiences.
My name's Kaylee Sorrenti. I'm a transgender student at Saunders Secondary School. It hasn't been a very positive experience with the school board because they're not trained to deal with my issues. Back before I transitioned, I didn't think there'd be a rest to my life. I didn't think past a day-to-day basis because I felt like killing myself. Even though I'm okay with being an advocate for myself, it shouldn't be the case. I'm in a public education system, and for my age, I'm a very strong-willed individual, but that's not the case for all the trans people I know in my school. A lot of them are afraid to come out, and they're afraid to be themselves because of the attitude of these students. Teachers bully students just as much as students bully students. I've been constantly bullied by teachers, and I've seen bullying happen even with students who are cisgendered. I see it all the time. In fact, the other day in one of my classes, one of the students who definitely is having a hard time at home, who comes to class and doesn't do their work, gets bullied by the teacher because he has his head on his desk all day instead of talking about what's going on. The teacher just constantly puts him down. The days when the teachers bully me, I don't feel like doing work. I don't feel engaged anymore. And I've had weeks where I haven't felt like doing any of my work, and I fell behind and failed tests because of these teachers incessantly bullying me. They try to tell me not to be so sensitive. They're not dealing with the issue at hand. Instead, because it happens so much, they just try to tell me these things happen and you're going to go through a lot of stuff and it's hard to live your life. And it's not helping me, and it's not putting any disciplinary action on the teachers, which they themselves stated they have a problem doing. I don't know how to deal with blame the victim, as my last resource to go to is administration. And when they're telling me this, I don't feel like there's anyone else I can go to. I'm going to the head of my school. And if they don't support me, then no one is going to support me in the school.
And there's currently several human rights cases filed against the London Board of Education, one of them by Kaylee, and a few other students who, you know, there's six cases that are going forward to the Human Rights Council, and quite frankly, Kim and I could put forward probably 30 or 40.
At least,
without even blinking an eye and having a difficult time naming names. So this is a situation that the school board has got to get on top of, and they've got to get back to it in a hurry, because you want to talk about budget crunch? Wait until they have to pay out $2 million to trans kids for their absolute absurdity that bullying students and bullying teachers are doing to these kids in the schools, plus the admin. So, probably the number one issue that we're dealing with in 2012.
Bullying and brutality.
Yeah, so on to the brutality piece. I can't go 2 days without a story coming across my news feeds that include police brutality somewhere in North America. And the cases are getting worse and worse and stacking up. We have guards in prisons that are kicking people in the head. We have police that are kicking people, pushing them down, sexually assaulting, raping, murdering, shooting, tasering, all kinds of actions that are happening across this country, and I can't even begin to list the stories. I mean, there's over 100 sexual assault cases against the RCMP that are in court. Every single police force has multiple officers. There was one report in Kitchener-Waterloo that they had something like 10% of their officers off with pay because there's proceedings against them. I have a current human rights case against the Ontario Provincial Police who absolutely petrified myself and my partner on the side of the highway for being lesbians, searched our car, screaming at us, where are the guns and drugs? Neither of us have any criminal involvement whatsoever. We don't do drugs at all, and those of you that do, that's fine, but we don't. And there is nothing that indicated that they should be asking us where guns and drugs were. So here is a clip from a documentary, just a little piece of it, called Police Brutality 2012.
Houston police pursued, where Chad Holly was trying to make a run for. He's hit by a police car. On the ground, he clearly puts his arms out in the surrender pose, then folds his arms behind his head before police move in. But look what happens next. The first officer stomps on his head. He's repeatedly kicked. We count four officers doing the kicking. Then one officer lands five separate kicks. It looks like the kicks are landing on Holly's head. You'll see more kicks. Holly is put on the ground, cops on top of him, all around him, for about 20 seconds. And then another police officer lands five heavy punches. The officer who did the kicking in the beginning does it again, this time from behind. Then he stomps on the back of Holly's legs. Then just before Holly is picked up to be taken to a patrol car, there's another lick. Just minutes after we made our copy, the federal judge, who had blocked release of this video, was on the phone trying to stop its release. It was too late. Houston police officers were indicted for what you just seen on video, but on misdemeanor charges of official oppression, not assault.
I want to know how did they do what they did to that boy on that videotape, and they only got charged with official oppression.
12 officers were punished in the wake of the Holly case. Many of them have been given their jobs back against the city's will. And the four officers who were indicted have all pled not guilty.
Around 10,000 people marched through central London on Wednesday to protest against a government hike in university tuition fees, which they say is impoverishing students. But the police were also out in force. Around 4,000 officers were deployed to control the demonstration, and they weren't tolerating any unauthorized activity. One student leader said the police had tried to prevent her from turning up to voice her outrage at government austerity measures.
I personally was arrested last February by the Metropolitan Police on the offences of criminal damage against a police vehicle following last year's student demonstrations, and I was entirely innocent. And even though I was let off and all charges were dropped, I still received a letter from the Metropolitan Police on Tuesday, and that warned me not to come to the demonstration or else I might risk further arrest or further face criminal damages, criminal offences.
Alex Peters-Day also criticised the police for deploying undercover officers who pretended to be part of the protest, but who she said were provoking trouble.
Throughout the demonstration, I witnessed firsthand when undercover police officers were working throughout the crowd. They would snatch demonstrators, pull them over barriers. They were all dressed in black blocks. They'd have their face covered, sometimes them wearing hats. They were really obvious. And you can't do that. You can't go around inciting behaviour, trying to get students and young people to commit either criminal offences or just get rowdy and then arrest them. It's entrapment and it's not right.
From the beginning of the march, the police surrounded the protesters and made it very difficult for anyone to leave the pre-authorised march routes.
Police has been very, very aggressive today, trying to provoke the demonstrators, and actually before the demonstration, right, telling that they were going to use, whether they were allowed to use rubber bullets, sending letters to people that were apprehended in previous demonstrations, saying they advised them not to come on the demonstration. Clearly, a lot of scare tactics, clearly a lot of attempts at intimidating the movement. Luckily, I don't think that was successful today.
Roshan Mohammed Sali, Press TV, London.
The RCMP admit they've received angry calls after the last minutes of Robert Chikanski's life were broadcast. But there are also questions about why the earlier police statements don't seem to match the video.
This will not boost the image of policing generally, never mind just the RCMP.
Some say the credibility of the RCMP is at stake after this tape was broadcast, video that was released after police were threatened with court action.
I looked at it and said, oh my God. This is really like a third-rate country, a banana republic, trying, you know, to treat this man really badly.
What seems so surprising about this tape is what it shows, compared to the version the Mounties told us a month ago. This was Sergeant Pierre Lemaitre one day after Robert Chikanski died.
They found the man in the secure area with his luggage cart and chairs set around him. They tried to do the same thing, communicate with him. Chairs went flying. He grabbed the computer off a desk and threw that. They just weren't getting through to this guy, and the violence again escalating.
And, you know, that's just a few examples of police brutality. You know, and look up that YouTube video on police brutality 2012, and you'll follow us on Facebook, and you know, there's constantly stuff up there. And, you know, when we talk about brutality against a community, I don't think that First Peoples of this country, you know, they're probably the biggest and most victimized by brutality, by colonialization and patriarch systems. And, you know, they were here, we came, you know, we didn't assimilate into them. And I mean, I can't tell you how many people tell me, well, this is a Christian country, why don't people learn the language and why don't they follow our religion, you know? And you know, Europeans came to this country and did none of that at all with First People. They just conquered and took over. And then, you know, when we negotiated a treaty, nation to nation, to share this land, that ended the violence, but it didn't. And then this country still has continued to fight. And here is our last clip, and that is on Idle No More.
Well, my name is...
And that is Idle No More, and Teresa Spence has been on a hunger strike since December 11th, trying to get the government of Canada to repeal C-45 and all of the other atrocious bills that were in the omnibus bill that you know, eliminate, you know, our sovereignty over land, the ability of people to say no to mining rights, for everything that are in the treaties that, you know, have been around since the 1800s, and Harper has decided that he's idle no more, and Canada has decided that they're taking no more, and being idle no more as well. And good luck to Teresa Spence and all of the First People leaders who are meeting with Stephen Harper on the 11th of January, you know, in solidarity with you and everyone else in this province, in this country, in this world that are fighting for basic equality. You know, we're there, we're fighting with you. And we will continue the fight to the best of our abilities. And here at Between the Margins, we will bring you the news, bring you the stories to the best of our ability through 2013. So I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Kim Gautreau.
And hopefully you have your happily ever after, whatever that means to you.